and the male, the old and the young, the noble and the humble, the leader and the follower, all should stand together. It teaches us that the enemy's front, despite all its outward strength, is highly vulnerable. It demonstrates that in the endeavor of defending one's faith, above all, insight is needed for individuals. Those without insight are deceived. Those without insight find themselves on the side of the falsehood, often unknowingly, just as there were those in Ibn Ziyad's front who were not wicked or sinful, but they were bereft of insight. These are the lessons of Ashura. Indeed, these lessons alone are enough to uplift a nation from disgrace to dignity. These teachings can shatter the front of disbelief and arrogance. They are the lessons that give life. And by his sentence, in fact, Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, is referring to these lessons for the youth in order to have a perfect Muslim society. Okay, dear listeners, thank you very much for being with us. For ending, let's just recite the sentence of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh about the month of Muharram and the movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. In that regard, he said, "You should know that if you want your uprising to be preserved, you would have to keep these ceremonies of mourning." May Allah protect you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran,
Salam. I'm a nature enthusiast and traveler. In Close Up Iran, I introduce you to the wonders and beauties of my country, Iran. Stay with me. Today is one of the hot days of summer. Let me turn on the air conditioner. Aha! Great. In Iran, every house has an air conditioner to alleviate the heat during the summer. However, long before air conditioning, and even long before electricity, Iranian architects found a very clever way to cool off. Yes, Iranians invented those ingeniously made wind catchers. You know what exactly they are? Today I'm going to take a trip to Yazd, known as the city of wind catchers. So, if you're interested in Iranian wind catchers, don't miss the trip. Wind catchers are a traditional Iranian architectural design that create natural ventilation in buildings. The basic design consists of a tower that rises from a building below with openings at the top. Many old buildings in Yazd province, central Iran, were built with magnificent wind catchers. Wind catchers work in one of three ways. The most common way is to cool the inside of a building. The tower has openings that face the wind and catch it, creating airflow inside the structure. When used in combination with a connaught, air is drawn down into the connaught tunnel and comes in contact with the cooler earth and cold water. The cooled air is drawn up through the wind catcher, which faces away from the prevailing wind, not only creating airflow, but also cooling the air. In a windless environment, wind catchers operate like a solar chimney, allowing hot air, which is lighter, to flow upwards and escape out the top of the tower. Combined with thick adobe walls, wind catchers are surprisingly effective and able to chill lower-level spaces. Wow! Yazd has a unique Iranian architecture. Look at the alleys. Brilliant. Dazzling. Well, before I totally get overwhelmed by the beauty of Yazd architecture, let me tell you what I have decided to do. Well, I was wondering if I could visit the Dolatabad Garden in Yazd. You know why? Because the tallest existing wind catcher is there. Okay, why not? Let me find it in the map. The Dolatabad Garden is located in Chahar Minar Quarter in Yazd. Not a long way to go. Here it is. Ladies and gentlemen, let me welcome all of you to Daulatabad Garden, where the tallest wind catcher in the world exists. Well, as far as I know, this garden was built more than 250 years ago. Wow. Here we enter the garden. Look at it. The garden is a masterpiece itself. Wow, look at the greenery. And the fountains which pass through the land. Beautiful. Gorgeous. These items were made in order to lessen the heat, of course. You can call it a gem in the heart of the desert. And the story was about this masterpiece of architecture. Yes, the wind catcher, or the tallest adobe wind catcher in the world. It's proudly rising from a mansion in the garden. Oh, it's about 34 meters tall. Captivating the structure. This wind catcher is octagonal, which lets wind flow from any direction into the building. On the other hand, there is a pond located under the internal deflector of this wind catcher to cool down the interior space. By combining wind and water in the pools of this structure, cool air is transferred from the wind catcher to the building. Oh God, I was wondering how genius Iranian architects were at that time. Wind catchers make the scenic city of Yazd full of charm and beauty. Wind catchers offer a sense of timeless beauty, and at the same time, they play a key role in making the interior spaces, cellars, and water reservoir cool. Though there are wind catchers in the world, especially in the West Asia region, never forget that these structures are exclusively Iranian.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Thank you. Derby English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to Derby English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Derby English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, how to behave with an open enemy of Islam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, it is an honor to be here at your service. Dear listeners, we are talking about how to behave with an open enemy of Islam. Now, of course, we had talked about this very, very briefly. We just kind of pointed it to a previous program. But we really wanted to talk about this just a little bit more because it's very important. Now, we had talked about in a previous program how we should be lenient with our family members and our friends, which is pretty much common sense. But when it comes to somebody who is an open enemy of Islam, right? He is openly hostile to Islam. They have openly picked up arms against Islam. Well, to be lenient with that kind of person is pretty dumb. Right? Because an individual who has picked up arms against Islam, well, they'll most probably hurt you, harm you, if not kill you. So that kind of individual, I don't think you should be lenient with. And no common sense, rational individual would be lenient. You have to at least stand up and defend yourself in that kind of a situation. But we're talking about, for example, an individual who hasn't picked up arms. They are openly hostile, right, against Islam. Now, what do you do in this kind of situation? Well, first and foremost, you speak with certain individuals. You try to teach. You try to help them understand. Of course, this is done in a very proper manner, in a very appropriate manner, in a very honorable manner, right? We're not talking about getting into somebody else's face and becoming aggressive and start yelling and screaming. This is not what Islam prescribes us, and this is not what the Quran and the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt teach us, right? They tell us to encourage debate, encourage discourse, encourage speaking and conversation so that, you know, things are made clear and most probably that enemy will turn into a friend. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we're talking about how to behave with an open enemy of Islam. Now, we talked about the one who has picked up arms. Well, we have to defend ourselves. Then we talked about an individual who just based upon discourse and based upon talking is an open enemy, right? And in that situation, we talk, we discuss, you know, we tell each other our points of view. And in an academic, intellectual type of setting, you explain one another's side, you know, and hopefully, inshallah, by the grace and the blessings of the Almighty Allah, this person who was an open enemy of Islam will become a friend of Islam. If not, he might even become a Muslim himself. Now, what's really important to understand is that individuals who go through these kind of things, they have to realize that getting into somebody else's face or becoming highly aggressive or talking to another person in a disrespectful manner, this is something which is not allowed in Islam. We have to respect each other's boundaries. We have to try to talk in a compassionate manner, in a merciful manner, and help the other person understand. Now, at the end of the day, if the other person refuses to understand, well, then I guess we will have to agree to disagree on certain points. But hostilities and animosities and enmities against individuals that have the potential to become the friends of Islam is not allowed. But, of course, to defend ourselves against individuals who will not stop their hostilities and enmities against Islam, to stand up to such individuals, it is something that is part of Islam and our Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
In an interview, far-right Israeli minister Itamar Ben-Gvir said that the right to life and movement for settlers in illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank trumped the right to movement for Palestinians. Palestinians have long railed against travel restrictions, including checkpoints imposed on them by Israel in the occupied West Bank. Ben-Gvir, who lives in the Jewish settlement of Kiryat Arba, near the flashpoint West Bank city of Al-Khalil, said in the interview the curbs were needed to protect his family's security.
My right, my wife's right, my children's right to move on the roads of Judea and Samaria are more important than the right of movement for Arabs. This is the truth. My right to life tops their right to movement.
The international community, along with the Palestinians, consider settlement construction illegal. More than 700,000 Israelis live in the occupied West Bank and East Al-Quds. Following Ben-Gvir's comments, the Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs condemned his remarks as racist and heinous and said it only confirms Israel's apartheid regime of Jewish supremacy. Remarks by Ben-Gvir, who has a history of anti-Arab incitement and has long taken a hardline approach to the Palestinians, infuriated some legislators in the Israeli parliament. Arab lawmaker Ahmad Tibi strongly denounced Ben-Gvir, who oversees the police, for his provocative comments.
For the first time, an Israeli minister admits on air that Israel enforces an apartheid regime based on Jewish supremacy.
Karine El-Harar, a lawmaker from the opposition and a former minister, also reacted to Ben-Gvir's provocative remarks, blasting him as the authentic representative of the most racist cabinet Israel has ever had. The Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court defines apartheid, which is a direct symptom of military occupation, as a crime against humanity, characterized by the commission of inhumane acts such as unlawful killing, torture, and forcible transfer, which are committed to maintain an institutionalized regime of systematic oppression and domination by one racial group over another. Major human rights groups and UN officials have accused Tel Aviv of perpetuating such a system against Palestinians on top of the military occupation of their land and a decades-long campaign of genocide. Ben-Gvir, a member of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's far-right coalition, has been convicted in the past of inciting racism and of supporting a terrorist organization. More recently, Ben-Gvir has said Israel must kill thousands of Palestinians, called for flattening buildings in the occupied West Bank, and has led multiple raids into Al-Aqsa Mosque. The West Bank has been rocked by violence since early last year, especially with repeated deadly raids by the Israeli army. Israeli forces launch raids on various cities of the West Bank almost on a daily basis under the pretext of detaining what the regime calls wanted Palestinians. The raids usually lead to violent confrontations with residents. Settler attacks against Palestinians and their property are also a regular occurrence. Palestinians in Al-Khalil are particularly vulnerable to settler violence as well as Israeli surveillance. A former Israeli army general has blamed the rising wave of violence in the occupied West Bank on settlers who, as he described, go very wild in terms of provoking the local population, doing terrible acts of vandalism, sometimes terrorism against Palestinian families. The former head of the Israeli army's operations directorate, Israel Ziv, said Israeli settlers are definitely encouraged by what they think is the policy of the Israeli cabinet and the coalition today. The development came after a wave of recent resistance operations in the occupied West Bank. Against the decades-long occupation by the regime, more than 200 Palestinians have been killed this year in the occupied Palestinian territories in Gaza, the highest number of fatalities since 2005. The majority of these fatalities have been recorded in the West Bank. At least 30 people have also been killed in Palestinian retaliatory attacks against Israeli settlers during that time.
Iran has been invited to become a member of the BRICS group of emerging economies, whose leaders have attended a summit in Johannesburg, South Africa, to discuss the bloc's expansion. The South African President Cyril Ramaphosa announced on Thursday that the BRICS member states agreed to admit Iran to the bloc.
We have consensus on the first phase of this expansion process, and other phases will follow. We have decided to invite the Argentine Republic, the Arab Republic of Egypt, the Federal Democratic Republic of Ethiopia, the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates to become full members of BRICS. The membership will take effect from the 1st of January 2024.
The five current member states have reached a consensus on the first phase of this expansion process. Reacting to the news, Mohammad Jamshidi, the Iranian president's deputy chief of staff for political affairs, said Iran's membership in BRICS is a historical development and a strategic success for the foreign policy of the Islamic Republic. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi said Tehran seeks to promote cooperation with the member states of the BRICS group of emerging economies. He also noted that Iran, in its foreign policy, has put the promotion of relations with all independent countries in the world on its agenda.
And the benefits of Iran's membership to BRICS is going to make history and open a new chapter and a stronger step towards justice, fairness, ethics, and sustainable and lasting peace on the international stage.
The Chinese President Xi Jinping has said the expansion of BRICS will inject new impetus to the group's cooperation mechanism. This expansion has reflected BRICS' determination for unity and cooperation. He said this membership expansion is historic. The expansion is also a new starting point for BRICS cooperation. It will bring new vigor to the BRICS cooperation mechanism and further strengthen the force for world peace and development. Russia has also welcomed Iran's application and the group's expansion to include international powerhouses. Meanwhile, South Africa's foreign minister has said that leaders of the BRICS bloc have agreed on mechanisms for considering new members, giving dozens of interested nations a path into the organization. The inclusion of Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Iran, and Egypt marks the first MENA representation in the group, and the inclusion of Argentina was championed by member Brazil. The expansion of the group is part of its plan to build dominance and to reshape global governance into a multipolar world order.
Excellencies, we are moving towards a multipolar world, and that is a positive thing. But multipolarity in itself is not enough to guarantee a peaceful or just global community. To be a factor of peace, equity, and justice in international relations, multipolarity must be supported by strong and effective multilateral institutions.
UAE President Mohammed bin Zayed said he appreciated the inclusion of his country as a new member of the important group. We respect the vision of BRICS leadership and appreciate the inclusion of the UAE as a member to this important group. We look forward to a continued commitment of cooperation for the prosperity, dignity, and benefit of all nations and people around the world. The bloc's expansion raises the question of potential de-dollarization, a process by which members would gradually switch to using currencies other than the U.S. dollar to conduct trade. The expansion also takes place at a time when some BRICS members, namely Russia and China, are locked into rising tensions with the West. Experts believe that choosing to include countries like Iran, have opted to choose a foreign policy independent of the West, could swing the group further toward becoming an anti-Western bloc. BRICS held its first summit in 2009 with four members and then added South Africa the following year. It launched its new development bank in 2015. More than 40 countries have expressed interest in joining BRICS, and 23 formally applied to join the club, which already represented a quarter of the global economy and 40% of the world's population.
Has reportedly begun unloading cargo from a Suez tanker which is believed to have been transporting Iranian oil to Singapore. Suez Rajan, the oil tanker, has sat off the coast of Texas since May. Last week, a group of American lawmakers implored the Biden administration to end the impasse and offload the tanker. Ship tracking data analyzed by American news agency The Associated Press showed the oil tanker started ship-to-ship transfer of its cargo to another tanker, the MR Euphrates, some 70 kilometers southeast of Houston. The cargo aboard that vessel is estimated to be 800,000 barrels of oil, with an estimated value of $56 million. The spokesperson for the Iranian Foreign Ministry declined to confirm the report but warned the U.S. that his country won't remain silent on the violation of its rights. Nasser Kanani slammed the measures that involved attacking oil tankers carrying Iranian oil as a brazen example of piracy. He said the general principle is that the era of hit and run has been over. The spokesman emphasized that the Islamic Republic won't remain silent on any violation of the Iranian nation's rights, will show an appropriate reaction, and cut off the hands of violators. Already, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC, has warned that those involved in offloading the Suez Rajan's cargo should expect to be struck back. The IRGC's Navy commander, Rear Admiral Ali Reza Tangsiri, warned that Iran would hold any oil company seeking to unload its crude from the vessel responsible. He said Iran would also hold America responsible. Washington has claimed to have hijacked tankers carrying Iranian oil several times, arguing that the ships had been flouting U.S. sanctions. The U.S. usually auctions off Iran's stolen assets, claiming it would use the money to pay damages to alleged victims of the Islamic Republic's actions. Meanwhile, Washington plans to sell the confiscated Iranian oil and use the money for the victims and survivors of the 9/11 al-Qaeda attacks. Tehran accuses the U.S. of stealing its oil, saying the move is illegal. Iran has warned against the provocative buildup of American forces in the Persian Gulf, saying the move comes at a time when regional countries are improving their relations. Tehran says the security of the region, especially that of the Persian Gulf waterway, must be ensured within the region itself by the Persian Gulf states. In this regard, Iran, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Oman are to form a joint naval force under China's auspices towards enhancing maritime security in the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz. The Strait of Hormuz is a key strategic strip of water between the Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Oman, where near a third of the world's oil flows through. Back in July, the U.S. military announced it has deployed 3,000 sailors and marine forces to West Asia under the pretext of protecting ships and vessels crossing the main waterways in the region. A recently released footage from Iran showed an encounter on August 17th involving the USS Bataan and USS Thomas Hutner. The video footage released by the naval force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC, showed Iranian speedboats issuing warnings to a U.S. helicopter carrier in the Strait of Hormuz, forcing the warship to ground its choppers before they can enter Iran's territorial waters. The commander of the IRGC Navy, Rear Admiral Ali Reza Tangsiri, said his force's success in monitoring maritime movements in the Persian Gulf and their vigilance in the face of threats, particularly from the warships of extra-regional countries, proved that the Iranian forces would never allow enemies to undermine security in this strategic region. Iran has made it clear that it views U.S. military vessels lurking in the waters of the Persian Gulf as a threat to its national security and a source of tension and instability in the region. The Islamic Republic has repeatedly vowed to give a decisive response to any hostile move by Washington that would disrupt the security of the strategic waterway.
Nearly 1 month into a military coup in Niger, the situation remains tense there as the country grapples with political uncertainty. As part of efforts to reverse last month's coup, a delegation from West Africa's main regional bloc, ECOWAS, has met with junta leader General Abdourahman Tiani in the capital, Niamey. The delegation, led by Nigeria's former military leader, Abdoulsalami Abubakar, and accompanied by ECOWAS Commission President Omar Touré, has also met with Nigeria's ousted President Mohamed Bazoum. Although there has been no detail on the outcome of the talks, General Tiani said in a televised address that neither coup leaders nor the Nigerian people want war and remain open to dialogue.
In short, neither the military junta nor the people of Niger want war and remain open to dialogue. But let us be clear, if an aggression is launched against us, it will not be the easy ride that some people think it is. They will be up against 26 million Nigerians.
Tiani said the junta was pursuing its own agenda and would launch a national dialogue to consult on a transition back to democracy, which should last no longer than 3 years.
I am calling on all the living forces to engage in an inclusive national dialogue. The aim of the body dedicated to this dialogue is to consult all the components of the people of Niger on the best ways to lay the foundations of a new constitutional life on pillars deeply rooted in our traditional and republican values.
Tiani's comments and meeting of ECOWAS representatives with coup leaders and former President Bazoum come as the bloc on Friday doubled down its threat to use force as a last resort to restore democracy in Niger. It said an undisclosed D-Day had been agreed for possible military intervention there. This was enough reason for thousands of Nigerians to hit the streets of Niamey to throw their backing behind coup leaders. The developments in Niger come as coups are normally rejected by nature, no matter the time and place they take place. But the public support for the military junta does indeed convey a message. The disillusionment and dissatisfaction with the previous regime can be named as such. A desire for change and a belief that the military might bring stability or address grievances that have not been adequately addressed by the previous government is among reasons behind the public support for Niger junta leaders. But in the case of the West's stance toward Niger developments, what comes to the spotlight is Western countries' push for a military intervention in Niger to reverse the coup. Are they really seeking for the establishment of a civilian rule, or are there real concerns that the persistence of a military rule would not meet the demands of people across the West African nation? Western countries claim that they are involved in a fight against terrorists linked to Al-Qaeda and Daesh. But taking a glimpse at West's interests in Niger proves that seeking a civilian rule in Niger for the sake of its people would be so naive. In the case of France, Paris is seeking to maintain its grip on valuable uranium reserves in Niger. After all, the French government is entirely dependent on Niger, as some 25% of Niger's uranium production goes to France. Using that uranium to produce electricity, Paris has become a large exporter of power that goes to Germany and other European countries. This makes France huge profits, which make it hard for Paris to admit new political changes in Niger. In the case of the United States, Washington is seeing a growing tendency toward Russia among people in West African nations, including Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali. Maybe that's why, seeing its political interests in tatters, Washington is pushing for a military intervention in Niger to reinstate the pro-Western president. All what it is, the fact that Niger belongs to Nigerians and they're the ones who should decide their own fate is of very high significance. Given all the anti-West hatred among the people of Niger and other nations across the Sahel region, it seems that it is for the West to stop meddling in the affairs of those countries and let the people decide their own political future.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The Zionist regime forces have shot and killed two Palestinians, one of them a 16-year-old boy, during a raid in Aqbat Jab refugee camp near the occupied West Bank city of Ariha recently. According to Wafa News Agency, 11 Palestinians have been killed in Aqbat Jab refugee camp since the beginning of the year 2023. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, Defense for Children International Palestine said that the slain teenager, Qusay Suleiman, was shot in the hand and chest. The second slain Palestinian was identified as Muhammad Najm, 25. The Zionist regime's war ministry claimed that the pair had opened fire at troops during the raid. However, eyewitnesses told the Tel Aviv daily Haaretz that the teen was unarmed. According to the eyewitnesses, the newspaper reported Qusay was shot while he was riding a scooter, and there were other young people with him, some of whom were armed. Occupation forces arrested Muhammad Abu al-Assal, 20, at his home during the raid. Eleven Palestinians have been killed in Aqbat Jab camp since the beginning of the year. The camp has been subjected to regular Israeli regime raids and comprehensive movement restrictions after the emergence of a new resistance group called Aqbat Jab Brigade. Around 170 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank by the Zionist regime forces since the beginning of the year, surpassing the total number for all of 2022, according to the UN Monitoring Group, OCHA. Last year had already witnessed the highest number of fatalities in the West Bank, including East Al-Quds, since 2005. At least 215 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli regime police, Zionist settlers, and troops throughout historic Palestine since the beginning of this year. That figure includes people who died from injuries sustained previously. Last week, Israeli regime forces shot and killed Amir Khalifa, 27, during a raid in Zawata, a village near the northern West Bank city of Nablus. Khalifa was said to be a member of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, a resistance group associated with Fatah. The Israeli regime military said troops had returned shots after coming under gunfire. That same day, Israeli regime forces shot and killed Mahmoud Jarrah, 23, during a raid in Tul Karm refugee camp in the northern West Bank. another Palestinian was critically injured during the incursion. Meanwhile, Wafa News Agency reported Israeli regime occupation forces raided recently the Al-Shibli Mosque in the old city of Al-Khalil, south of the occupied West Bank, breaking its windows and causing damage to the sacred site. Nedal Muhammad Al-Jabari, the director general of the Islamic Waqf in Al-Khalil, expressed his condemnation of the attack, describing it an act of aggression against a place of worship that is unacceptable and goes against the freedom of worship. This targeted Zionist regime attack raises concerns about the safety of religious sites under the Zionist regime military occupation in the occupied West Bank. Wafa also reported Israeli occupation forces launched an attack recently on Palestinian fishing boats operating off the northern coast of the Gaza Strip, and that's according to local sources. Wafa correspondent said Israeli naval forces indiscriminately opened fire and launched tear gas canisters toward the fishing boats that were operating off the Al-Sudania coast in the northern Gaza Strip. This aggressive action forced the fishermen to abandon their work and leave the sea. It is worth noting that Israeli naval forces frequently target Palestinian fishermen off the Gaza Strip, depriving them of their livelihood sources under safe and secure conditions. These attacks have become a daily occurrence, leaving the fishing community in constant fear and uncertainty. The ongoing harassment of Palestinian fishermen by Zionist regime naval forces raises concerns about the blatant violation of international maritime laws and human rights standards. The economic stability and well-being of fishermen-led households in the Gaza Strip heavily rely on the ability of fishermen to access the sea for their work.
Digital footprint.
Part 3.
Disclosing digital identity does not always lead to psychological harm to children. Sometimes it involves crimes and abuse. In recent years, these issues have been taken to court. Sometimes parents unwillingly conspire with online predators by sharing their pictures. Sometimes even laws take their toll on individuals' privacy, especially in the US. According to the laws in the European Union, people can force search engines to remove the results related to them. But such a law does not exist in the US.
I think that in coming years, we'll see more governments try to get involved. I think also, you know, more tech companies are realizing that users don't actually want this permanent record about themselves with all of their information dating back years and decades.
Although the freedom of the press in the U.S. has some positive aspects, it doesn't allow such laws to pass. That's why children's footprints on the internet are indelible. You might argue that the younger generations are not sensitive about their privacy, but studies have shown otherwise.
Things that are meant to be texted one-to-one, people tend to post online so 50 other people can see their plans for tomorrow or the next weekend. You could be doing something like that could potentially endanger yourself by making your account public and saying too much about where you live or who you are.
When I'm in like a
cool location and I want to show everybody where I am, but most of the time I'll just tag where I am on like a Snapchat story so people can know.
What you share and how often you share is going to affect the way that somebody views you. Just because I'm going to post all the time, that doesn't mean that you're going to get all the attention. That doesn't mean that everybody's going to like you.
Observations confirm that younger users care even more about respecting privacy. The popularity of apps like Snapchat in the US is because of that. Younger users and teenagers choose the app because it keeps data for a shorter period of time. You can share your videos on the app for a specific time and they can't be recovered in the future. Steinberg stresses that children have the right to decide about their own privacy. She says children become aware of their own identity at the age of 4. The awareness can be a reason that parents should ask for their permission. They have to ask if the children allow them to post the pictures or the content. When parents talk to their children about posting the pictures on the internet, it doesn't mean that they shouldn't post them. Talking about it means that children will become more aware of their digital identity. It can give them the chance to think about different aspects of the internet and, of course, can serve as a great guide for their future in the digital world. Respecting privacy has to be a part of the education. A child who doesn't have good memories of their published pictures will probably violate other people's privacy when they grow up.
Could it be considered exploitation?
Oh, I'm sure it could. Anything could be considered exploitation. I know one thing for sure is that children don't need this amount of attention or money or toys to have a great upbringing. And so those things can distort. And you only have to look at all of the child actors and celebrities that have had difficulties through that.
What happens if or when people stop watching?
Well, that all comes down to parenting. They will, you know. Well, they won't necessarily. It's just that no one's going to watch a 22-year-old opening toys.
Children and the issues related to them continue to make headlines from time to time. The Dutch parliament has passed a law that obligates companies to prove that they don't employ children in their production chain. Any company that breaches the law will face restrictions in distribution of its product. Putting a ban on employing children is not limited to the Netherlands. In a recent case, an Irish singer has been convicted for using children for racketeering. Kelly brought his son William to the stage so they would sing a song together. The court issued a verdict that what he did was an example of abusing children for business purposes and he will have to pay a fine. There are similar laws that bar children's exploitation, but no one talks about the other types of exploitation. Even the laws have been stifled to serve the interests of major companies. In 1939, after the tragic incident Jackie Coogan experienced, a bill was passed, which is known as the Coogan Law, to protect children from abuse. The law stressed that employers should deposit 15% of the children's salary in a special account. The children will have the right to withdraw money from that account after they come of age. But even the Coogan Law isn't applicable to exploiting children on the internet. Now children work both in the real and digital worlds. In underdeveloped countries, children work with machineries, and in advanced countries, they work with computers. This is the age of child influencers. children like Ryan, Anastasia, and the boys of the Wixens family. The million-dollar question about them is what Kukan asked himself. Parents do business with their children, but it isn't clear who their revenues belong to. The material and spiritual revenues are so interwoven with the children's privacy that it's really hard to draw a line between them. Some people have chosen the title Digital Child Labor for the subject. The borders between the rights of the children, parents, employers, and the audience are blurred and fuzzy. Their working on the internet has a misleading appearance, but in fact, it isn't different from working on the streets or in factories. It has given a completely normal face to their exploitation in the digital world.
She says she wants to be an actress when she grows up. But the question of exploitation has never been far from her mother Katie's mind.
There will be people out there, there will be a school of thought
that
believes that this is wrong for a child to be on social media so young.
I think everyone has their opinion and the right to their opinion. And I still don't think it changes the fact that me and Daniel are really good parents and Ava's a very, very happy, well-adjusted child. And if she came to me and was like, I don't want to do this, it would stop. I don't want to cross the line where it could be considered exploiting. You know, I kind of let her control what goes on the profile.
What is that line? Where do you draw the line?
I guess, I don't know. I think it's different for everyone. Some people would think I am.
The court says presenting a child on the stage is against the law. But it doesn't say anything about the tech companies that take advantage of children's pictures. The laws warn against exploiting children, but they're silent about using the information about them for advertising on the internet. It seems some major IT companies, some laws, and some families are against children. Their privacy is breached under various pretexts. Their digital footprints are used as a tool for business, and their identity is a plaything to attract a larger audience. The consequences of the Karen situation will come to light in the not-too-distant future. Children's digital footprints left by other people will change their future, like what happened to the kid in Charlie Chaplin's movie.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.